Okay, let's resume our meeting. We're going to talk about financial instruments with characteristics of equity. Manuel.
Thanks, Hans, and good afternoon, everybody. So we've got a couple of papers that we would like to discuss with the board today. Agenda paper 5B will hopefully cover a major part of, or finish covering a major part of the board's deliberations on the classification and presentation of derivatives with on own equity. And agenda paper 5C is going to begin the board's discussion of disclosure in this project. It's the first time we've talked about disclosure, so it's the focus of that paper is going to be pretty much on what information we would like to discuss in the discussion paper in terms of disclosure, as opposed to how the format, the detail of the specific disclosure requirements. Before I pass it over to Uni and Daisy, who will be doing most of the talking today and not me, I just wanted to make a couple of remarks about the project in general. I provided agenda paper 5A for information only. Again, this is just the running tally of the board's decisions and discussions today. I just wanted to point out that hopefully after this meeting we would have covered a major part of this. There are still some topics that we need to discuss at future board meetings. They include issuer-held settlement options, which might include discussion of economic compulsion, and we have some additional areas of IAS 32 that we need to cover for the sake of completeness for the discussion paper. If there are no further questions or comments, I'll turn over to Uni.
Philippe? Thank you. Just a small question on the introduction, paper 5A, paragraph 4, page 2, where you say that the following topics will remain: interaction with other IFRS, IFRIX, and the conceptual framework.
Yes.
And I have a question about the kind of feedback loop between this project and the framework and the timing of each projects. How you see that moving? Because if we want to finish the framework relatively early, i.e. End of this year, beginning of next year, how do you see that, how do you, working on that idea?
Well, first of all, this project has been kind of decoupled from the framework, so liabilities and equity is beyond the scope of the conceptual framework project at this point in time. What we would be doing is, as part of that discussion about the interaction with the conceptual framework, is thinking about potential implications for any future amendments. And remember, we still need
the framework, of the framework?
Potentially. Whether we need to. That's, the board has said in the past that it would consider whether any future amendments might be required as a result of this research. Of course, we still need to go through the consultation process, publish a discussion paper, elicit feedback, and go through that. So by decoupling the two projects, hopefully it shouldn't prohibit the board from finalizing the conceptual framework. But that's not to say that any future amendment is not possible.
All right.
Uni?
Okay.
You switch it off.
In July, the board discussed the classification of derivative on an equity under the gamma approach, and today we present the agenda paper 5B on how we can use the presentation requirements to provide the information that complements the classification under gamma. Specifically, the information that enables the users of the financial statements to distinguish income and expenses that arise from changes in the residual amount from income and expenses arising from independent variables. And that's what we mean by separate presentation in this paper. Under the gamma approach, there will be derivatives that are completely independent of the residual amount. On the other end of spectrum, there will be derivatives that are solely dependent on the residual amount, and there are also some that are in between the two. The derivative that are neither completely independent nor solely dependent on the residual amount. One example being rights issues in foreign currency. This paper deals with the presentation requirement for the last type of the derivative. In this paper, we explore two alternative approaches to defining the separate presentation requirements, namely the disaggregation and the all-in or all-out. The disaggregation approach will, as the name suggests, disaggregate all income and expenses arising from the derivatives into those arising from the residual amount and those arising from independent variables. In theory, the disaggregation approach should achieve our objective of separately presenting the changes arising from residual amount. However, we encountered challenges when we tried to apply it to an example. As illustrated in the paper, paragraph 37 to 43 of the paper, this approach produced different answers depending on the order of the calculation. This is due to interdependency that cannot be discarded. The second approach is called the all-in or all-out approach. This approach will result in separate presentation of all income and expenses from a derivative, depending on whether the derivative meets particular criteria. By all-in, we mean all income and expenses are presented in profit or loss as they would for any other ordinary derivative. By all-out, we mean all income and expenses arising from a derivative are separately presented, for example, in other comprehensive income or as a separate line item or subtotal in profit or loss. In defining D criteria, Stott believed it important to note the key risks in designing the separate presentation requirement. One, the separate presentation requirements may become too complicated in a way that undermines the understandability and usefulness of the information to the users of the financial statement, which is the objective that we are trying to achieve. The complexity also means increased cost for preparation. Two, another risk is that the separate presentation leading to structuring opportunity. At one extreme, an entity may try to achieve separate presentation of a derivative that includes speculative and unrelated exposure by including some on-equity exposures. Bearing these risks in our mind, we thought it would be appropriate to look at existing criteria that has a similar objective and that we may be able to leverage. One we have identified is the closely related assessment of the embedded derivative under IFRS 9. We are not proposing that we directly use the closely related assessment, but what we have done is to use the closely related example in identifying the type of exposure that are relevant to our purposes. As a result, we identify two types of relevant exposures, interest rate and foreign currency. As noted in paragraph 21 to 25, in our view, under the gamma approach, interest rates that represent compensation for time value of money will not preclude equity classification. For example, share conversion option in a plain vanilla convertible bond will not be classified as a liability purely due to an indexation of the bond to a benchmark interest rate. On the other hand, other types of interest rate exposure that are not related to the time value of money of the derivative will not qualify for the separate presentation. We therefore do not further consider interest rate exposure in defining the all-in or all-out criteria. That leaves us with foreign currency exposures, and we know the foreign currency has been and would likely to remain as the main source of practical challenges in applying the classification requirement. We, however, do not want to allow the separate presentation to all types of foreign currency exposures, as this could give rise to structuring opportunities. Therefore, we propose this separate presentation to be limited to only specific types of foreign currency exposure, as we set out in paragraph 29 of this paper. The conditions are inclusion of no other independent variables apart from the foreign currency exposure, no leverage, no optionality, and perhaps most importantly, the requirement that the foreign currency exposure not resulting from the entity's choice. In the staff's preliminary view, the all-in or all-out approach seems to better achieve our objective, considering the practical difficulty in performing the disaggregation to a sufficient degree of accuracy and the difficulty in interpreting the results. We acknowledge that the all-in or all-out approach is not free from challenges. Notably, under the all-in or all-out, we allow some income and expenses arising from independent variables to be separately presented. To mitigate the risk of this leading to structuring opportunities, we propose the scope of separate presentation to be limited to specific types of foreign currency exposure, as mentioned earlier. In this paper, we used an example of a standalone derivative to illustrate the how separate presentation requirement would apply. The application to an embedded derivative will be similar once the embedded derivative is bifurcated from the host contract. We have outlined a number of other assessments that are applicable to embedded derivative in paragraph 46 of the paper. We would like to highlight the paragraph 46 is not meant to indicate the order of the assessment that needs to be performed. It's about how many assessments. We have also included in the paper the application of the separate presentation to the statement of financial position. We believe that derivatives that are neither completely independent nor solely dependent on the residual amount can be presented as a separate class of derivative, separately from those that are solely dependent and those that are completely independent. Now I'd like to turn it over to the board for comments and discussion.
Daryl.
Thank you.
I've been appointed to be volunteer.
Good.
This does result in, because we are not making it expedient, it's effectively saying that if we go the all in all out approach, you have to apply to the entire contract. You can't, for example, bifurcate the contract. And that is even in the circumstances where you have the information available to do that. And we're consciously doing that because we value consistency over perhaps the better economic representation. Is that a fair question?
There are problems with the disaggregation approach, which we tried to illustrate in the paper, in particular, because some of the variables arise from the interdependency of the contract. They cannot be separated, and so they will end up in one place or the other. And depending on the facts and circumstances, the characteristics of the contract, that may be quite significant. And so the risk there is that there might be some anomalies. However, having said that, you know, the disaggregation approach, if it did work perfectly, would potentially meet conceptually what the requirements are. There's also the practical complexity of doing the disaggregation and how useful it will be to users to interpret. With regards to the all-in or all-out, what we're trying to say is perhaps if we're not going to do a disaggregation, perhaps there is a set of these derivatives that we think better belong together with some of the other derivatives that are classified as liabilities, and we are applying the separate presentation requirements to, rather than being presented together with all other derivatives of the entity. Now, of course, that approach is not perfect either, which we highlight in the paper. That results, of course, in some of these derivatives being separately presented. Some of that exposure, for instance, to foreign currency, would also get separately presented. And some of the other derivatives which don't meet that criteria, changes in the residual amount would be presented within income and expense without necessarily prescribing any separate presentation. So there is some element of looking for some aspect of consistency and comparability with regard to a particular narrowly defined set of derivatives. but for some of the other ones, especially where there's some other indexation, commodity indexation or other equity indexation other than own equity, then that will be presented together with other information, and perhaps we can think about other ways of helping users understand, and we'll talk about disclosures later about how that might help in terms of the...
I've got to play through in my mind then, if I'm thinking about the one case that we've spoken about in the space, which is
yep.
the rights issue
yep.
that occurs both in your local fund, in your local currency and in a foreign currency. The local currency is easy, we know exactly how to treat that, we have a specific designated treatment for that. The second element would be the one with the foreign exchange element in it. Because it's got the foreign exchange element in it, it fails the test. What we're saying is that that is a type of instrument that we would then take both the rights component and the foreign exchange component to this special separate presentation.
Yes.
Even though arguably we have sufficient data available to know what the rights component is, because we have a near identical rights instrument in place in local currency.
Absolutely, Daryl. But also I would like to point out, in this case, if you have these dual instruments, you could come up with a difference. But there will be quite a few circumstances, and I think more frequent, where you won't have two marketable instruments where you can make this difference comparison. So there you will have to do a computation or a disaggregation, like what we have done. So in cases where most of the things, you continuing with the foreign currency example, the instances where I've seen is that the reason why it's issued in a foreign currency is because you can't issue a local currency. So that is where you won't be able to do that comparison because you won't have it. The other point I would just like to make is that, you know, if you look at disaggregation, it's more theoretically pure, we can do it. It would not just be Forex, it would be others. So if you have a third variable in there, the chances of doing that comparison of like and with and without with the two market instruments, so for example, it's equity, Forex, and not unknown, commodities. To pull out an instrument which is just linked to equities and commodities and not Forex, and then compare it with one which has got all three, that becomes all the more challenging. So it's, I would say, in more rarer occasions will we find where we can get a direct market comparison. I'm not saying it cannot be done. Yes, the people who have the sophistication can strip it out. Banks do hedge it, but it will be complex.
It's probably worth also clarifying the context of my question, because what we're talking about here is only presentation. So at
yes.
some previous point, we have already made the decision under the gamma model that something is either equity or liability. And part of the difficulty is we have an instrument, as I've just described, that
yes.
in one sense is equity, in another sense
yep.
is liability.
Absolutely.
Stephen. I would like to not dismiss the disaggregation approach quite so soon. Can I ask a question first? So what's the plan for the DP? To mention it at all or not, or what?
Well, it depends on what the board decides today, I guess. But
what would you like us to?
We would cover both of them, the advantages and disadvantages. I guess depending on where the board ends up, we would cover more one more than the other, but we will definitely include both of them.
I would like a neutral depiction.
And we just ask the question.
Would
yeah.
you like
well,
us to ask the question, Steve? That's
because
the key thing.
Because I think you're overplaying the problems a little and underplaying the other situations where we do it. So we do this disaggregation in own court. I know it's different, but it's still subjective. And you said earlier about if it worked perfectly, could we come up with a sort of reliable way of doing it? Well, we accept that in other areas we don't. So bifurcating a convertible for a presentation on the balance sheet, that's not perfect either. We're going to be issuing an insurance standard where changes in fulfillment cash flows go to two different places. And depending upon the order with which you do that calculation, you get a different answer. But we do all of these things because we enhance the information content as a result of doing the disaggregation. And I think it's there is information content in isolating the equity, the equity component that drives the change in the fair value. So I'd be reluctant to dismiss the disaggregation approach so quickly. One point, in somewhere in here you say that if we do it for the purpose of the statement of comprehensive income, then we also need to do it in the balance sheet. I don't agree with that. There is one instrument and one fair value, and it is the change in the fair value
that we are disaggregating,
that may or may not be disaggregated, and disaggregating it may have additional information content. So I think that's what we should focus on, and I don't agree with mentioning anything about the balance sheet.
Okay.
Sue?
I actually agree with the approach of putting everything in one place, all in, all out approach. Because whilst Steve's right that there are other circumstances where we slice and dice things and we know that they're imperfect, in all other circumstances that I can think of, we've never split into a derivative in our literature anywhere that I'm aware of. Even in own credit, if you've got derivative components, you have to put the full fair value of the derivative in P&L. That's an explicit exception to the own credit requirements. So everywhere else we have derivatives, we always measure them as a total unit, as far as I'm aware. So it'll be the first time we've gone to the complexity of disaggregating. Secondly, I think in all other circumstances where we've got a derivative that's not equity, we always value the derivative at a true fair value. So for example, if you look at the embedded requirements, you always measure the derivative first so that the derivative is a true fair value, and then what's left over we use as the balancing item. The only exception we've got to that is where the derivative itself is equity in our minds, which is the compound requirements in 32, where you value the liability first and the residuals the equity. That's the only exception we've got. And I think we got there in our literature because it is equity, so by definition it's a residual. Whereas here, I think we've concluded that the overall thing is a liability. Mm. But now we'd be ending up, we could disaggregate, we could certainly come up with a rule and say measure this first bit, and this bit first, and then the rest is the residual. But then some piece of it we're allowing not to be truly measured at its fair value. And so personally, I wouldn't go there with that complexity because it's a step too far for me. So I'd stick with the all-in, all-out approach. And I think that the way that you've thought about foreign exchange, subject to wording suggestions, is a sensible sort of way to go.
Mary?
I think we should cover both of these in the discussion paper. I think if we have a preliminary view, I mean, I think it's worth testing whether we have one, and if we do, putting that in, but even if we do, I think we should build out, identify the challenges that we see with the other view, and say to people, if you prefer the other view, could you explain how you would approach these difficulties, so we don't just get a, oh, I see everything that's wrong with your preference, I'm going to vote for the other one, you know, kind of thing, that we elicit more robust input. And I think we should cover both, but I think it would progress things better if we express a preference. I'm very marginally kind of swayed by the staff argument about complexity, etc., to make me agree with the staff preference for the all-in. But I think it's really close, and I do have some of the concerns that Steve raised. I couldn't have articulated what Sue said about, you know, the counterbalances, but having heard them, I think that those are good rebuttals and would be the right kind of thing to catch. I think, going back to Daryl's point, one of the things that we probably should make very clear is that we aren't overriding the basic IFRS 9, what is the unit of account, do you split it or not? What we're talking about is disaggregating the change in the measurement of the whole thing. And it's just reminding people that this is not an exception to what we've just put in IFRS 9. Now, in terms of the criteria for all in, all out, do you want to talk about those now or do you want to hold that? Okay. In terms of the criteria, one of the things I was really struggling with was the imposed by the market for two reasons. One is the question of should we care why an entity is taking on this risk? Because whether it's because they elect to,
yeah,
you know, have a U.S., your example, U.S. dollar denominated instrument, or because the market, by absence of a functional currency, forces them to a U.S. dollar, one way or the other, they're still taking on the same exposure. So I'm not sure we should be focused on motivation. And I think that's, again, something to explore. Having said that, I then have questions if we were to take imposed by the market, how effectively we could operationalize that. Because imposed by the market, to me, raises the specter of economic compulsion. Is it imposed by the market if the U.S. dollar, you know, example, is cheaper, a lot cheaper, you know,
how much?
How much? And so that makes me think about whether there's any other precedent we could look to inspire our thinking about this. Maybe there's something in IFRS 9, and the hedging that says, why are you doing this? And basically making the point that you don't get to segregate and present separately the changes that come from speculation. And that maybe isn't at the end of the day that different from imposed by the market, but it's kind of where you're starting and how much, where you put the onus in terms of demonstrating something like, why, you know, why did I do it? Why am I doing it this way? And then in terms of going back to the disaggregation approach, I think if we can, what we should try and do, whether we're doing a neutral presentation or whether we have a preference, even if disaggregation is not the preference, we should try and be clear about which element we're focused on trying to pull out.
Yeah.
And if we say that it's what we're trying to do is exclude from the normal subtotal changes in value that relate to changes in the residual, then I think when we look at which order you do it in, you know, if we're clear that the objective is this, what you're trying to do, so to the extent there's any imprecision, it should fall in the other bucket. I think rather than specifying mechanics, we should be focusing on objective, and is that the right objective for what you should be trying to isolate? So said, on balance, I fall very marginally on the side of the staff recommendation for all in, but I think we should have a full exploration of both and talk about what we think the objective is and what we see as the challenges, and if people are supporting the other one, ask them how they would answer what we see as the challenge and do they agree with what we see the objective of disaggregation would be, for example.
Martin.
Similar like what Stephen has said, because I think you're a little bit overplaying the negative things of the disaggregation approach. Clearly it is not precisely possible to make this distinction, but I would guess it is possible to make a good estimate of that, especially if it is only an FX component if you have to disaggregate. Therefore, I think in the publish a discussion paper, I would like to see a more balanced view of both approaches, what are the pros and cons. And I especially don't like the all-in, all-out approach, not very much, because what we are doing here is, okay, we try to solve this question of, we have clearly derivatives, what are liabilities, and we have movement in the value, which are a little bit counterintuitive, because it is based on the value of the company, and then for one instrument which they issue this in their own currency, we have it then maybe in, hopefully in OCI, but I think that will be the solution, likely solution. And other than we have an FX component which we say based on market, because they cannot issue it in their local currency, they have also the opportunity to show that in OCI, but then the companies which have exactly the same instrument, but okay, have only chosen to issue that in a foreign market, they have to show that then into P&L, and that is not solving the overall problem which we, I think, have to solve. And therefore, I don't like this all in, all out, and I would prefer to have this disaggregation approach. I understand it is complex, but I don't know if it will not deliver precise results. But I don't question if it is so judgmental. I think it is some not precise thing, but I think you can come up with good estimates if you disaggregate it. I'm not an expert, but I'm maybe to learn more, is it really so problematic to come up with this disaggregation?
Makes sense. Few comments, some are, sorry, repetitive, but I think they are still important for me to conclude. First of all, I'd like to commend the staff for the quality of the papers again. I really enjoy reading the papers. I think they are thorough, they are detailed, they provide the basis for us to better judge the issue. This is not a simple issue, as of course you've stated already. So just I would like, my main comment is related to the complexity, operationality versus presentation and disaggregation. So this is only presentation, this is one of the bits of the whole proposal. And in the classification, we are not requiring disaggregation. So to me, it's a little bit counterintuitive to conclude that it's not appropriate or it's very costly to disaggregate for classification and then come to presentation required to everyone. I understand, and I'm very sympathetic to Martin's comment, but this is my concern, to come into presentation requiring disaggregation for everyone. So intuitively, I think it's not the best way to require presentation. That being said, I think because this is the ADP, I think we have the benefit to test our view if this is really appropriate, if it's really responsive for mainly users and investors that are requesting us to provide more information that make them more comfortable in judging this sort of instruments. So because it's a DP, I think we can explore the alternatives, or as Stephen mentioned, do not disregard the disaggregation. However, I think being a DP, we have to have a position.
Yes.
I think we have to start, and I do agree with the proposal by staff. I think this should be the starting point. And in some way in the DP, sometimes we do it in an alternative or together, I don't know how to do it, but in some way in the DP, explore or provide more detailed information in the way Mary suggested or whatever. I think on one last comment that is Mary made already, it's about language. I don't think this might not be the language, but the 62D in the imposition by market. Yeah, this I think is very sensible. I come from a market that issues loads of instruments in foreign currency. Sometimes it's not only the concept of my reading of the imposition by markets is broader, and maybe we can capture this. Sometimes it's because there are no demand for the amount to be issued, or sometimes even if there is demand, there is no liquidity in the secondary market, so they have to go abroad. Sometimes it's the appetite for these instruments is abroad because of the opportunity in terms of interest rates or whatever. So I think it's this staff's proposal. It's a good way to, as a starting point, as our position, I think would provide the comparability that many have argued for. And this will be, of course, complemented by the disclosure. That is the next piece that we are going to discuss. So we cannot forget the disclosure on all of this.
Doc. I agree with Amaro. It will come with disclosure, so we can make some compromise. So in this sense, I support the staff's recommendation. And actually, this solves a lot of problem occurring all over the world, especially in the developing country where they have to issue the
instruments with foreign currency, which is not the their functional currency. Having said that, let me ask a naive question. Say, for example,
that's a deadly one.
say, let's see the rights issue denominated in foreign currency. So based on the gamma approach, it goes to liability. But if you issued rights issue is your own currency, it can be classified as equity. So in that case, if that rights issue meets all these criteria, then the subsequent change will go to OCI. If we go down the route to the OCI, and then that means the subsequent change goes to equity, whereas the body, main body of the derivative, go to liability. But it's a little bit counterintuitive to me, because the main body itself has a nature of equity. And then the foreign exchange has a nature of liability, but the outcome is completely the other way around. So that is what I can't really understand. This is a good compromise, but the outcome is not very much intuitive to me.
Well, I think this is why we have the proposed a separate presentation requirement. So if we go back, disregard the derivatives we're talking about here, but for instance, a cash settled, fixed or fixed derivative, or some liability, a shares redeemable at fair value, where the change in the liability results from changes in the own share price. I mean, this is some of what to many people appears counterintuitive. When the share price goes up, you recognize an increase in the liability, and then you recognize an expense for that increase. And by separately presenting, what we're trying to do is separate out those phenomena from all the other phenomena normally found in the income statement.
In terms of profit and loss accounting, I understand. However, once we use OCI, it goes to equity anyway.
Yes.
So then the main body of derivative goes to liability. And only the forex part, which is more like liability, goes to OCI.
All fair
value changes, but
including the FX. That's correct. That's why.
Yeah, but the changes, subsequent changes. The original amount
is still
goes
liability.
To liability. Yeah. So therefore, my concern is original the amount itself has a more like equity, because it's same rights issue as if it were issued in local currency.
When we said at the last meeting that we're only going to classify derivatives on own equity as equity if they are solely dependent on the residual, so no other variables, and also if they're physically or net share settled, so there's no liquidity demands on the entity. Now, if it fails that, but there's still some the value of that derivative is still driven by the residual amount. This is why we've proposed the separate presentation requirements, just to ease that tension. Because if we recognize all those changes through P&L, that's where a lot of the tensions come up. So what we've proposed is just to have the separate presentation requirements, just to ease some of that tension of that binary classification.
So we only solve tension in profit and loss.
Yes.
Yes.
That's what the tension.
Sue.
Just a couple of extra observations on disaggregation. If we were to have disaggregation and it were to result in a piece going to OCI and a balance going to P&L, I don't think we can be too sanguine about that, given that that means that people are going to have flexibility in terms, or some level of flexibility in terms of what ends up in P&L. So I think the fact that we got a derivative and we're splitting it potentially between OCI and P&L is a pretty big deal, right? So we'd need to at least be clear on how they do it with some level of specificity. Also, sort of relatedly, which is why we didn't go there with much enthusiasm on the DP on macro when we looked at an OCI alternative for similar concerns, right? Also, usually today, if we have disaggregation, we end up with the whole not summing to fair value once you get past day one. Usually you have one thing that's been remeasured, one that's a residual, and then the two things never add back together again. I would have thought that if we had disaggregation at a minimum, we'd want the aggregate to keep being fair value.
Yes.
Yeah? So different to what we've done before.
Yes.
Also, I guess one of my concerns with disaggregation is if we go with all in, all out, I think that we can say, you know, we've got certain special cases in mind where we have this sort of additional thing that's going on over and above the debt equity distinction for derivatives. So we're saying for some type of instruments, derivatives, even though we've given it a liability label, because of its particular nature, we'll give it a different presentation, right? If we start to disaggregate things where there's a flavour of equity in there, so here we've got a flavour of FX and a flavour of equity, I think if we start to strip out equity bits and leave other bits, there'll be quite soon a push to say whenever there's an equity bit, strip that out. Yeah. I think it's going to be harder to hold the line on scope if we go with disaggregation. On scope, just one last thing. I'm relatively more relaxed on disaggregation and presentation because of the scope, because I think we're talking a relatively narrow population. So I think having a scope along these lines is an important thing for me, because otherwise I think whenever you get a link to some residual flavour in a derivative, you're going to get pressure. And I never thought I'd sort of be saying anything good about the embedded criteria,
but
I will. And I guess if you look at the embedded criteria today, we already have these sorts of notions of routinely denominated, commonly used, all of these things. And I think that the flavour of what you're trying to get to is along those lines. It's never a very black and white scope, but in practice, I think we tend to get reasonable sorts of outcomes. Having said that, I don't think the words that we've got of
imposed
by the market is what we really mean, because it's more subtle than that. It's what's normal, where's the market available, where's it deep enough, which is a subtle thing, I know, but I don't think we've got no precedent for that type of logic.
Can I just a couple of things which I want. Yes, I agree with Martin. If there are banks who can do this, and maybe it shows my age, I still bear the scars of reassessed expected outcomes. It was not very different from what we are trying to look at. But let's not forget, one of the other big volume of instruments that we are trying to cover are convertibles, which are issued by corporates, not banks. Banks are the holders of these instruments, not the issuers. And for them, when you have these option features in there, this kind of doing a disaggregation is most probably not going to be that simple.
But they won't be able to, right? Because IFRS 9 won't let them.
Not for the holder, I'm saying for the issuer. The corporates who are, if you ask them to disaggregate, that's where the challenge. For the holder, the whole thing will be a fair value, so they can do it. The other point which I wanted to make is, because of this reaction, so the restriction which we have put is that it's a residual, and every time you have to link it to the total must be at fair value. So think of a situation where one end, so what we do is keep one side constant and let the other side move. So I have seen instances where the share price has moved up or the vol has moved up and the forex has gone in the other direction, where the total adds up to zero. But with the way I measure this, I could end up with a negative component. So it's not just measurement, but it's explaining whichever order you put this, this will come up if these things, countervailing things happen, is what is the explanatory, or what is the information power, and how do people explain that? So it's not just the complexity of measurement, it's sometimes also going to be, how do I explain some of the results, because it's keeping one thing constant and letting the other vary, and it doesn't matter which order we do it. The last bit, which I said, absolutely, what I had in mind when Mary was saying the imposition imposed by the market doesn't necessarily work, what I had in mind was commonly used and routinely denominated. Are the, I don't want to say concepts, but some of the thoughts or the what people are used to now in applying to see how we can operationalize the last condition.
Steve?
I wanted to talk about the criteria as well for the all-in, all-out. I think this is really important if we go down the OCI route. As Sue said, putting in OCI is a big deal. If we leave it all in P&L and it's simply presented separately, it's less of an issue. It also depends on how we do it. These criteria trouble me because there's no objective here. There's no principle. And it has the flavor of anti-avoidance or trying to sort of specify a situation which is sort of somewhat arbitrary. So, for example, you may be forced by the market, however you want to express it, to issue a US dollar convertible because there's no local market available. Or alternatively, there may be a local market available, but you choose to issue a US dollar convertible. Is the economics any different because you have a foreign currency convertible? And from an investor's point of view, if you're trying to analyze returns, you're in exactly the same position. So why should the existence of the market or not affect what goes into OCI, which of course is a big deal? So I don't really understand the criteria that we've got here and why we've come up with these.
We have modeled it on embeddance because the fundamental thing when we looked at what other variables could potentially go in, which would be, how shall I put it, close enough to get equity, the separate presentation requirements, this is the one we came up with. And one of the thoughts which we are considering, and I don't I absolutely agree with Steve, it's an element of anti-avoidance is in there because we have used the embedded criteria. The embedded criteria, the thoughts behind embedded is anti-abuse. The basis also says that you shouldn't be able to get away from derivative accounting by putting it in another contract. So if you have used that, there's an element of anti-abuse. And because I think finally where the staff landed was that the Forex is one which is common, which is the complaint, and seems to be the one which most people have been forced to, the other instances we haven't seen. Now what you're asking is there a principle to say why is Forex special and why not any other form of indexation? That's one which we have heard from the market, that's what where the issuances happen, and that's where we already have some existence relief given in 32. Other than that, what is the general principle? I think that's the driver, and we could ask people in the DP, do you think, is there anything else that you would like us to consider?
My concern is, because it's largely anti-avoidance, anti-abuse, it's going to invite structuring. So you have foreign currency exposures not leveraged, that's fine. But I might have a standard foreign currency derivative and I put an equity exposure in there which is deleveraged.
We'll take care of that, that's the point you made.
Okay, so I've thought of this structuring opportunity in a few minutes. We're gonna have people out there thinking of it rather harder than that. Are we gonna capture everything?
It's impossible to capture everything, but I can promise you one thing. If I look at the disaggregation, because the scope of application is much wider, because any kind of variable will there, I don't think we'll have any less structuring opportunities in there. And there, the measurement flexibility is also quite significant. It's weighing between the two. I can't promise you one will be more than the other, but I don't think the other one will be any less either.
Could you have a broader scope and disaggregation, Steve?
Well, what I'm coming to is the next discussion on OCI, so because this is all a problem if it's put in OCI.
Well, but it's all a problem if it's put in OCI.
So you're talking line items.
Line items, yeah. Go on, that's your response.
At the moment with the FX rights issue exception as it stands, we've got situations where we have a similar situation where some similar economic exposures are classified as liability and some are classified as equity. The ones that are classified as liabilities are measured at fair value with all the changes through P&L. The ones classified as equity do not get subsequently remeasured. We have thought about attribution requirements for equity, but because the board's not only limiting that to fair value measurement, I don't think classifying these as equity is going to be useful for investors. Classifying them as liabilities guarantees that they're going to be measured at fair value, and so the full exposure is going to be measured. But then we need to think about what to do with the changes, especially those changes that result from the changes in the share price. And so what we've thought, we've come up with two ways that we might resolve these issues. They both have advantages and disadvantages. On balance, and I don't know whether, you know, there's a strong feeling, you know, particularly one way or the other, we've come out with the all-in, all-out type criteria to that might better improve the existing requirements that are there for IS 32.
Mary?
I think there are more three bits. One is, if we keep going back to the embedded criteria, and you say that's the genesis of imposed by the market, if we have a concept and that, you know, people have got used to, rather than try and attach a new label because it's in a new setting, it seems maybe more sensible to be more explicit, unless there's particular baggage associated with it that we don't want to bring along. But I think we should take that head on, rather than saying it's very close to this, we're just going to give it a new label, and that kind of gives permission to start redeveloping all the practice that goes around it. So that's something to think about, being clear how much it's mapped on that and whether we expect the same outcomes. A second, and this is something that Uni highlighted as one of the basic considerations, is let's not lose sight of the complexity issue, because I think that's one of the things we could forget about in the debate about is it possible to do these things, and could we specify it, because it's not just the question of, oh, don't worry, it's good complexity, I'm willing to do that as a preparer. I think it's the complexity of a broad range of users of financial statements, understanding where the boundaries are drawn and how the separations are done. So I think we should be asking ourselves some of the questions that, like, is the amount that's left a meaningful number that we could describe, except to say it's a calculated number, you know, if we're starting to take things apart. And we just should remember that in terms of the, you know, what both pieces mean. The last is, I think it's kind of manual what you were just saying, is so far we're identifying only FX as special enough to be worth thinking hard about some kind of special presentation. And I think we have to keep reinforcing the point that it's special enough to think about special presentation of the changes in value. It's not so special that we're overriding the classification requirements of gamma, which is what happens today with FX rights issues. So we aren't thinking about overriding the basic classification criteria. We're talking about special characteristics for changes in value, and really driving that home, because I think people could misread it and think they're getting exceptions to classification.
No. And we've thought about this quite a bit, about, you know, what makes FX special. Are there some of the criteria that are more relevant for the objective that we're trying to reach in sort of defining this? This set, it's a difficult set to define. And for instance, you know, some of the criteria, for take commodities, if a commodity index derivative met all of those criteria as well, would that be okay? Is it the FX part of it, or is FX just, you know, the exposure that would generally meet these types of criteria that we've specified? And we struggled a bit with justifying which criteria are probably going to be more relevant for what we're trying to do. I mean, we certainly wouldn't want a derivative that's indexed to frozen concentrated orange juice to be classified as, or to be separately presented, but where we've come out, I think, probably captures the population that we think is probably going to be most affected.
Philippe? Thanks. I'd like to go back to the discussion of the criterion imposed by the market. Let's assume an entity as a functional currency like, not very stable currency. Let's say there is a currency risk and wants to tap investors in the US. The conditions for issuing the rights are quite different, whether they issue rights in local currency or in US dollars, because there will be some form of protection maybe for investors in US dollars. The amount of shares to be issued under the right issue might be different, whether it is a derivative in a local currency or in US dollars. So the entity may say it is my most advantageous market to issue in US dollars, the derivative, rather than my local, my functional currency. There is a notion of most advantageous market that we have in IFRS 13. Is that something which is understood as being imposed by the market? It is still an entity choice. It is a logical choice. It is the best governance, the best stewardship, whatever you might call it, to issue in US dollars instead of local currency because of market conditions. How would you analyze this kind of situation in the light of what we propose here, imposed by the market? Economic compulsion, or maybe not compulsion, but best management, best stewardship?
I hadn't thought about it. That's also a good concept, most advantageous market.
Firstly, Taka, you mentioned that, you know, if issued in local market, it will be equity. If issued in another country, then liability.
Will not be equity. I think there's a confusion. It's not equity.
It's not equity.
It's still a liability. You don't discuss derivatives which are equity. It's still a liability, but the changes in fair value can be disclosed separately. Yeah.
I think what Weigu is saying, yes, absolutely, it will always be a liability, but you are saying the instrument, if it had not been issued in a foreign currency.
It seems contrary, the changes will be recorded, let's assume, in OCI. OCI will be equity, and he feel quite, not understandable. But for me, no problem, the recognizing OCI is in the broad, the income statement or performance reporting, the result. But transfer after that to equity, it's totally different story, We have so many items, recognize something in profit loss or OCI, and either the profit loss or OCI will transfer to equity. Yeah, but does not mean, this. I would not have such kind of confusion.
I understand that point. My point is, probably I confused you. Probably what I wanted to say is the criteria you explained is a good criteria. So why don't we use it for the classification as well? Because if we use it only for the separate presentation, for the profit or loss only, its outcome is not really, really straightforward. Because if the derivative itself, if it was not denominated in foreign currency, is an equity nature. In that case, the main body of derivative is equity nature. But because of the foreign currency denomination, it is classified to liability. However, now we are going to introduce a threshold like this. So then we can understand this is, in nature, it's equity. But because of this some nuisance, it was classified as liability.
But I think,
back to equity.
But
I wouldn't call it just a nuisance. A little bit more than
But I think I think that's a very kind of potentially dangerous,
very dangerous
argument, because all liabilities would be equity but for the characteristics that make them liabilities.
So possible.
So I think
not possible. That will happen.
Well, by definition, yes.
I mean, by definition, yes.
So I think we just need to remember that what we decided for classification, we wanted to limit it to derivatives that are solely dependent on the residual amount, okay, so they don't have any independent variables that influence their value, and that are also settled without requiring the transfer of cash. And so we wanted to keep that the notion of those equity instruments quite pure.
Yeah.
As soon as you get some of the other characteristics, then they flip over to liabilities. We understand that where there are these borderline cases, and there's a grey area where there's a mix of attributes, but this is why we're proposing the separate presentation requirements to alleviate some of those tensions and to make it a bit easier to communicate those economic phenomena.
Yeah, but my point is actually I'm not going to change that notion, but the notion is clear. If it's a local currency, so the nature of the derivative is clear. It's equity nature, but because of the foreign currency, it now classified as liability. And I wouldn't say nuisance, but I think it's nuisance. Because if you look at purely the nature of derivative, it's equity, then why don't we, you know, classify it as an equity? Otherwise, you know, put it in a separate presentation and put different, you know, presentation, and then put it OCI or profit or loss. It's a somehow strange discussion. It's not really tackle the real core of the problem.
I think I would say the real core problem on classification is what we are applying gamma to. And there are certain consequences of that.
Yeah.
And we are aware of what are the challenges that come out of one of the consequences. Yeah. And we have always said that from day one that we cannot solve all the problems with classification. We'll have to use both tools. And that's exactly what we are using. Because if you start extending this to classification and everything, as Manuel said, everything is equity until it meets the condition of a liability. And it does meet the condition of a liability, there's no doubt.
Okay.
General.
Thank you. I'll go back to the original point. You know, Darren was forced to ask. this all out approach is a kind of practical expedient. So what I'm saying, I have a similar idea. You know, you better develop, analyze this aggregation approach more. You know, about real settings, whether really this is really difficult, you know, to segregate all these effects, independent one and the dependent one, as many people are suggested. If we can use this disaggregation approach rather than all in and all up out approach, it's much easier conceptually. You know, so this is a right approach. So in a sense, maybe. Like, you know, in the lease standard, if you cannot separate the service component from the lease component, everything must be treated as lease component. So it's a kind of another counter practical expedient we can introduce here. We are asking companies disaggregate everything. If you fail to do so, then everything is just an income and expense in profit and loss. This kind of a new approach might be possible. So I strongly suggest you to analyze in more details of this the advantages or disadvantages of the disaggregation approach.
Okay.
I can choose how much control I have over P&L.
Oh, I can.
Philippe?
Another maybe a side question not directly related to that, but maybe very kind of linked off. Listening to the conversation on the foreign currency Is there a test of materiality about the variability introduced by the forex exposure? Let me illustrate. I'm a Norwegian company. My local currency is Norwegian kroner, but it is pegged to the euro. There is very little, if any, variability to the euro. And because all my shareholders or potential investors are euro-based, I would issue shares in euro. But the risk, the forex risk is nil or practically immaterial. How does that impact the classification? Is there a materiality test in that variability, and this forex variability, to decide whether it is equity or liability?
We just depend on whether it meets the definition of the functional currency. If it doesn't, then it's...
I could even have decided to have euro as functional currency, but for some reason, legal reasons, I could not have to report in Norwegian kroner. But it is equivalent whether I would report in euro, because there is so much of a link, direct link between the two. But so I have to report in Norwegian kroner. My financial statements are in Norwegian kroner. It's totally indifferent whether they would be in euro, because to me the same, just dividing by whatever is the exchange rate. So I issue a rights in euros, but there is in appearance, so it's formally there is a forex risk, but in effect, in economic terms, there is no forex risk.
That's today, Philippe. The day that peg goes, and we have seen it many times
maybe
before.
Maybe reassessment, if there is a change, that significant change, but today, based on past experience, looking at the foreseeable future, there is no such forex risk. So
I don't think in anywhere with the, I will recheck, there was something vaguely going through my mind on hedging, but which is not relevant. But even if you're in the embedded, just because there's no variability doesn't mean you get out of it.
Yeah, but it looks pretty much like your rules-based approach and form rather than substance.
But here's the argument. I've worked in quite a few jurisdictions where this peg, everybody said, oh, that's nonsense, we don't have exposure. One day the peg goes. And it was only recently in Europe, one of the countries which this happened. Not a peg, but the bands were dropped. So then the exposure comes up. Then we'll have to bring in reassessment as well.
Yeah, well, you may have to reassess when this happens. But absent a foreseeable change in that condition, I'm not sure I would be so strict. I would prefer to look at substance rather than form.
Martin, and then I think we should go to the next paper.
And I really think we maybe should discuss question number three before we come to a conclusion into that, because what we heard is, depending on what we decide, does this go into OCI or not? And if it does not go into OCI, it is still only a separate P&L presentation. I don't care so much in our all-out approach, but if it goes to OCI, I care a lot. And then I would support more the disaggregation approach, and therefore I think it is, we should not make maybe decision based on that without having a discussion on OCI or not.
Okay. Go ahead.
So which one are we taking first? do we want to take another OCI question first? Okay. So question
three.
And this is only for preliminary view.
And again, this is only for a preliminary view for the discussion paper.
Remind me what instruments it applies to.
So this would include instruments that apply the separate presentation requirements. So fixed for fixed, cash settled derivatives, embedded that are separated. And we've already agreed that we're going to have some discussion in the discussion paper about the interaction between the existing literature on separation of embedded and the fair value option and how that might interact. And also, if there are any non-derivatives that depend solely on the residual amount. So in that case, we're thinking in particular of shares redeemable at fair value on demand. So they would apply the separate presentation requirement. We did discuss whether that requirement would be applied through separate presentation within P&L, but we didn't discuss too many details about how that might be implemented, or whether we should apply the separate presentation in OCI. The board discussed this in February. didn't reach a preliminary view then because it wanted to see how the classification and presentation of derivatives might pan out. So we've reproduced the analysis in this paper, and we're asking you a question about whether you want to form a preliminary view about the separate presentation being in P&L or OCI for the purposes of the discussion paper. We envisage that both of the approaches would be included in the discussion paper for comment.
The question being, does presentation in OCI enhance the relevance of P&L?
Yes.
Stephen.
I understand how putting it in OCI would work. Presumably there wouldn't be any recycling.
Yes.
But I don't understand what is meant by subtotal and separately presented in P&L. So could you elaborate what that actually means?
We didn't discuss the how we might implement the separate presentation within P&L. At the very least, it would be a separate line item that would include all of the instruments that would apply the separate presentation requirements. However, we could consider a subtotal, and we might monitor the other project to do with financial reporting.
A separate line item is easy, and we've done it for many, many other things. To give transparency to a gain or loss that's different in some way. But in this project, it's not going to cut it, is it?
No.
Because we're going to have these counterintuitive amounts going through the P&L. It's part of net income. We have no mechanism for doing anything other than a separate line item. So everybody's going to take them out in their non-GAAP adjusted measures. And they're not going to like it in the first place because it affects the bottom line and we're going to get nowhere. So we have to have something more radical than simply separate line item.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, OCI.
That's our problem, isn't it? We only have OCI.
Exactly. Where else do we have to put it somewhere?
Well, I thought you were going to come up with a new section at the bottom of the P&L, post-tax, called gains and losses from remeasuring claims with an equity component.
It's still called OCI, but it means other counterintuitive income. I actually think that OCI should indeed be reserved for other counterintuitive income.
So, Steve, if we don't have, would you accept OCI then?
No, because of the baggage that OCI comes with. Uh-huh. Because people still don't think of it as gains and losses, income and expense. Uh-huh. It's thought of as taking it direct to equity. It's not really a gain or loss. We can think of it as gains and losses, and we can think of comprehensive income all we want, but the reality is that out there, people don't think of it that way.
Even sometimes labels taken like equity, because we are not prescriptive in IS1 about the title of the statement. I've seen many, especially by banks, which call it items taken directly to equity. This is OCI statement. They call it that way.
But having said all of this, it is very different. I mean, these gains and losses are so different from other gains and losses in the income statement that we've got to do something with it other than separate line item.
I've got a lot of sympathy for that, Steve, but we don't want to venture too far into performance reporting. We're already venturing quite a fair bit into it. Especially when we talk about attribution of, you know, changes in equity, et cetera. Is there any insight you might have about whether financial reporting, performance reporting project might be going? Because I think that's going to be the interaction between that project and this project in this regard, if we are going to be doing some separate presentation within profit or loss, might be quite relevant.
I think it would be good if this project came up with, this is what we need to deal with vice type problems, rather than necessarily saying that's your job, get on with it.
Okay, you think about that, Mary?
Couple things. One is following up on Steve's comment, and again, what do we put in a discussion paper? Even if we have a preliminary view, I think we should identify the alternative or alternatives considered. And Manuel, I hear your caution about not traipsing too far into the territory that's only starting to be explored in the performance reporting piece of primary financial statements, but I could see saying, consider three alternatives, separate line item within P&L, OCI, and the third is whether or not to explore further some kind of separate net of tax, but still in the face of P&L. This, however, has more interaction with that other project. We've picked X, assuming we pick one, or no more difficulties associated with that. It's true we haven't explored it, but I wouldn't say we can't touch that further thing. I think we could give the assessment that I'm guessing most people around the table will say separate line item within P&L probably isn't enough. I mean, you step back, and the question we skipped over, question two, I think was intended to confirm that we don't want to create any exceptions to gamma itself in terms of classification, even for these items. So if we're tightening up the classification and kicking things out of equity and moving them to liability, that's going to put even more, you know, we have pressure built up today, so that's going to create more pressure about whether the classification is right. And so I think it's likely that having only a separate line item within P&L, is not enough distinction. And so the question is there any alternative maybe to OCI? The second comment or question that I wanted to ask is, thinking about this non-recycling, everything we've said in conceptual framework is, as soon as you say, but don't recycle, every warning light should go off about whether this is, you know, the right decision or not. And before we say, well, this is just not recycling, I guess I'd like to work through not at the table, but ask the staff to think about whether if you had an item that was classified as liability and it ended up being settled through the issuance of shares, wouldn't you be transferring the amount accumulated in OCI relating to that item when it got satisfied? So it isn't recycling to P&L, but it means that the equity that you subsequently issue is measured not by reference to the original, you know, it's not the original issue measure, but it's the updated issue measure, and I think that would include anything in OCI, and what it's, and so it is not, I agree it's not recycling through the P&L, but I think this is one of those things in which you're almost running into the transactions with shareholders not impacting P&L, and that may be the reason that at least for things that get exercised, but you know, settled in shares, which is one of the possible outcomes for some of these, that it's not recycling through P&L because it's becoming part of the initial measurement of the equity instrument recognized. That still leaves the no recycling for the ones that don't get issued. But I think rather than saying, oh, and we don't recycle and they stay in OCI forever, we need to think about whether some of that would be permitted or I think required to be transferred if converted to equity instruments. And this, you know, think about that. Don't try and answer that now. But that was the thing that struck me as I was reading this section and just whether it was too sweeping to say in no recycling.
For me, this question is key, and I think we should give a few of support. We should do Because I think that is really essential, that for many people, okay, how to answer the other questions which we have in this project. Because when we have the gamma approach, and for me, the, from the beginning of this project, was really the main problem was how to deal with these instruments regarding performance. And therefore, I agree with Stephen, and if we only offer a separate line item, I think we will not do much to really what the concerns of people have with this kind of instruments, and therefore I think if we, my personal view is if we don't allow or prefer to have this OCI treatment for these instruments, it will be very, very difficult to get the whole gamma approach through, and therefore I think, I don't know what other board members think, at least we have to take a decision, because otherwise to leave it open, I think, is then very, very difficult for constituents to make their opinion about the other questions in this project. That is what I really think.
I would agree. And I truly believe that OCI, the one good purpose for OCI is to suit their economies of income, which are counterintuitive and which would give potentially misleading information about the performance of the company. So
I'm very torn on this one because I can see why, from a practical perspective, it's nice to choose OCI because I think it would help us get current measurements of more things in the gamma approach, but I struggle with it sort of from a conceptual basis. And I think that, well, one plea to the staff is not to overdo the analogy with own credit, because I think the reasons we did it are quite different. Not least, we limited own credit to non-derivatives because we didn't want derivatives to go through OCI, and we've made a completely different decision here. Also, the reason the board decided not to have recycling is because usually the instruments pull to par and aren't redeemed at anything other than par, and so there aren't really gains and losses that are crystallised to worry about, and that was inherent, very weighed heavily in the board's decision from my recollection. Whereas here, I think we really could have gains and losses, or we really will have gains and losses, and we're saying not to recycle them. The thing that I struggle with conceptually is that, and you sucked me in for a whole day on paragraph 68, and then I thought, hang on, because it's very appealing, this idea that it's like a share buyback, but it's appealing as long as you believe that you're dealing with something that's equity, but we've already decided it's a liability. So we're sort of trying to have our cake and eat it too, which I think is a less eloquent articulation of what Mary said, because this is not a transaction between shareholders. This is a transaction with a debt holder, and we wouldn't normally allow gains and losses on that to merely sit in other comprehensive income forever without recycling.
Any liability movement wouldn't go in there, sir.
And also the counterintuitive, and I know we went along with that with the own credit, and I know that often it is counterintuitive, but you can have situations where everything is measured and everything's measured on a current basis.
Yes.
And you're going to have perfect economic matching and accounting matching. It's because of the, you know, incompleteness of accounting and mixed measurement model that we get unusual outcomes, but that's not always going to be the case,
no,
right?
No.
And we even had to have an exception in our own credit because we knew sometimes it wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's going to be counterintuitive to stick the stuff in OCI. And we're going to have this here too.
I think that I completely agree, Sue, with that point. But I think another what we were also trying to achieve with separate presentation was to better disaggregate these phenomena, because you know the changes in the own share price is influenced by all other changes in the assets and obligations of the entity. And so it is, because it's dependent on the residual, it depends not only on the assets and liabilities recognized and measured through P&L, but also the ones recognized and measured through OCI. So it's, and this is where some of the counterintuitive issues come, because it's not only from the mixed measurement, but it's also because some of those effects are recognized in OCI, and then we're recognizing these changes in P&L, which seems a bit strange. But also just going back to where we started with the gamma approach, this idea of presenting the income and expenses that are independent of the entity all in one place and then the ones which are dependent on the residual in another place. And it comes back to performance reporting and the fact that we only have that single subtotal. And we say that profit or loss is the primary indicator of performance. And so that kind of puts us in a bind. It would have been better if we had some more subtotals, you know, maybe an operating subtotal financing section where we can show the leverage returns of the entity compared to the residual ones, but we don't have that yet. And
I completely get the separate presentation and completely agree with it, because I think the nature's different. I think some people are going to want to strip it out, so I think that's really useful information. Where I struggle with is the OCI, and I know that I'm not naive enough to think that if I put a separate line item in P&L, everybody's going to say, thank you, Sue, that's fantastic, I'm happy now. But I'm sort of a little bit torn in terms of what our approach should be in the discussion paper, because I hear what Martin said, and I think it's a good point that often we get the strongest responses if we've got a more concrete position for people to react to. On the other hand, if we are really struggling with, yes, I think all agree that having it visible is a good thing, but we're not certain where the location should be. If we were to sit a little bit more on the fence and have more pros and cons and what we're struggling with, maybe if people see that it's not that easy, it might help them to incentivize to give us more thorough feedback to help us with the next step of our deliberations. But I don't know.
This is where I think I'll go with Martin. Based on my experience with the last DP, which I worked on, 26 questions, 3 subparts, we don't get clear reviews. So if you want somebody to look at Gamma, which is going to push more things into liabilities and other things, we also have to tell them how we have addressed the presentation issues. I think this is one place where it would be useful to have a preliminary view.
Now, from the discussion, I think, you know, board members would prefer that, you know, balance the discussion of the two approach. And originally, I support, you know, the Martin's view to lenient to disaggregation for the reason of face presentation. And then, you know, Kumar challenged about the complexity. And then, you know, the Chung Wu offer an idea similar to a lease requirement, you know, if you can do or not. I'm not sure whether this can be considered or part of the discussion.
Let's be careful about sort of introducing options. I think with the leases requirements, I think the consequences are quite different to what we're considering here, because you're either in the revenue recognition standard or in the leases standard, I think.
I think the problem is...
Whereas here, I think we're talking about having an option to put something in
P&L
or OCI, which raises some...
No, it's related to how we discuss or how should we deny or accept this aggregation approach.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Two aspects. One is from the face representation point of view, or another one is the complexity. You know, how will we discuss this, you know, it is quite important, you know. And my second point related to P&L, you know, separate line items, you know, I think the dilemma is, you know, if we want to treat, let's assume to P&L, but separate line items, and we have to, you know, to put some, you know, like special or subtotals, you know, and very closer to OCI, just, you know, Steve suggests. I personally quite struggling about, you know, I would support subtotals, but I don't think board members should run into too rigid, detailed, you know, the choice in the future. And when we discuss the financial presentation project, always strongly against to, you know, have a rigid, you know, classification of particular items should go to this subtotal or another.
We have another paper waiting, so I see two more interventions. Can we make it short? Daryl.
So I probably agree with a lot of what Sue said. I think if we are thinking about this as just line items on the income statement, then I think the issue of disaggregation is not really that important, because there's nothing to stop an entity that has the capability of disaggregating from disaggregating. I agree that if we have not disaggregated, it feels like we're putting a lot of stuff into OCI that doesn't really belong happily in OCI, and I'd be very uncomfortable with using OCI in that space. I understand where PSU comes on the subtotal thing, but I think that, I don't know how OCI came into being originally, but I can imagine it being a conversation like this. Let's just have a second subtotal. And I fear that by legitimizing a subtotal within profit and loss, we risk inventing a new category called other OCI. That eventually becomes an issue. And then you have to think about things like the effect of, if you choose to hedge some of the non-equity risk, where does that hedge go? Does that also go to the other OCI line? So I would be very reluctant to make a clear view on a subtotal, I think, until we've got some sort of feedback on what might be a column presentation, what might be a linked presentation, what might be remeasurement versus non-remeasurement in the performance measurement process. That kind of all leads me to say, if we are going to come up with a view at this stage of the project, my review would be a line item in the income statement with the choice of segmenting it out into two line items, if you have the ability to disaggregate.
General,
thank you. Very quick. I agree with these two approaches, POIR and OCI. But how about, I would like to add one more thing. How about adding some kind of equity category? The reason why I'm saying is, your proposal here, you are just implicitly assuming the all-in or all-out approach will be assumed. However, if we can separate, disaggregate all this in the peer income and expense, peer change in equity, why not? In that case, we can put everything in a debt to depend on register return in some part of equity. So we don't have to think about this all kind of recycle of OCI. As you said, this is a kind of, even though this is equity term, but we are putting in OCI. All kind of excuses in your analysis can be avoided.
Yeah.
So this is another suggestion in the discussion paper, you think about it.
Okay.
Should call
them?
Yeah.
Should we? Our original preliminary view, the staff's preliminary view, was to use a separate presentation in using OCI. Does the board agree with that?
Nine in favor.
Okay.
Okay.
Can we go to question two? Mm-hmm. Sorry, one.
Yeah.
Which is, this is in the context of the decision you just made. With respect to derivatives on an equity that are neither completely independent nor solely dependent on residual amount, does the board agree with the staff's view that the all-in or all-out approach is proposed in the future discussion paper?
You're saying the board?
Given OCI,
it's a preliminary view.
Do you agree with the preliminary view of all in, all out?
Yeah.
It's
all in one place.
Yes.
Eight. Okay.
We received some comments about the criteria, which we'll take into consideration, but do you broadly agree with how we define the criteria, given the suggestions that you've made?
Nine in favour.
And final question, based on the discussions today, and I think probably, can we skip that one? Ask this one. Question two. Based on the discussions today with respect to how the proposed separate presentation requirements would apply under the gamma approach, does the board agree with the application, as we've decided today, to derivatives on own equity of the gamma approach? So that's question two. Page 27.
What exactly does that question mean?
So given, this is the package question. So given where we've got to, we haven't asked this before, given where we've got to the decisions to date about classification and presentation for derivatives in total. So this was the final piece.
So which are liabilities and which are equity?
I think the plain English version might be, A, did we screw up anything in the analysis of what the outcomes would be applying gamma strictly? And B, does the outcome panic you into thinking you want to go back and think about creating an exception to gamma? Is that what you mean? I think that's what you mean by question two. Do you agree with the application of gamma to...
Partly, Mary. I think last time...
Plainer English.
Last time when we were here, one of the key things which the board asked us is that you understand the classification, this is how gamma works, we agree with that.
Yes.
But before we agree whether you can put this in the DP and everything, we also need to know how the P&L side will be affected, handled by the presentation of this. So as Martin put it, a lot of the stuff is going to go through P&L. How will the presentation be a solution? So that was the OCI bit question preliminary. So we have given both sides of the package. We have to come and clear up some of the bits on the economic compulsion, issuer held options and other things. But we are asking the question that given you have seen the presentation, you have seen the classification in gamma, are you all happy for us to say that this is how the derivatives on non-equity, the DP will address
that? Yes, for this, even though I disagreed with OCI?
Yes, of course. It's a
is that true? Because I'm disagreeing with it.
That it's a liability.
It's a liability also. You do.
But also the presentation they're adding in.
It's a total package, yes, both sides.
They're not just talking with the miners.
Yeah. Well, if the board's passed the presentation, then that's done, isn't it?
It's done.
Yeah, I don't understand what the extra question is.
Yeah,
I feel like I'm being trapped.
Given the fact that we've chosen OCI, does that lead you to want to make an exception on
to the classification
of these classifications?
The change of classification, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm about to say yes, I'm fine, but I would be more comfortable if we were to test the whole thing to the NCI puts, with NCI puts, maybe with variations around the theme, like NCI puts in functional currency, NCI puts in foreign currency, how it works in terms of classification, and then how it treats. So, because it's a big issue we're trying to track, and in the list of the examples, in fact.
It's going to go to OCR.
It depends.
Fair value of the
one example of application of this approach, gamma. Whether I pay the put in issuing new shares or in cash settled or share settled. Just to recap the analysis applying to that situation, which is relatively frequent and we'll be having problems with it, I would feel more comfortable if I saw it. But in principle, I'm fine. But
yeah, okay. I think that's what we're looking for. I think in a future session, for instance, agenda paper 5A, we're going to update for the board's decisions. We'll include some more examples of instruments that we've covered, for instance, today and in the past on derivatives on own equity, just to illustrate the classification outcomes, what the board's decided today. So we'll include that in the next version of agenda paper 5A of the running total, if that's okay.
Okay. Given that, who is fine in principle? That's the playlist I can get.
Yes.
Yes?
11 in favor.
12.
12.
Yeah.
11 and a half.
Soon you need some encouragement. <was there. laughs>
Okay. Next.
So the next paper, Daisy?
Okay. Agenda paper 5C. In this paper, we focus on disclosure. The objective is to explore how disclosure might come together with classification and presentation as a package for providing information about relevant features of claims. In addition, we also explore how equity disclosures might be improved to the same level with liability disclosures in terms of quality, as currently there's a big difference between the two. However, in doing so, we're not simply looking to add more disclosures. Our focus is to consider whether existing requirements can be removed or modified and to justify any additional requirements. The relationship between existing and proposed disclosures will be discussed in the discussion paper. However, in this paper, while we suggest some disclosures and illustrations, we did not go into specific details of potential disclosure requirements. We also did not consider the level of aggregation for purpose of this disclosure. In the meantime, we will be monitoring the principle of disclosure project and see whether anything comes out that may help us when developing the specific disclosure requirements in later stages of the project. Based on our analysis, we suggest the discussion paper include discussions of three potential areas of disclosure, which are priority of claims on liquidation, potential dilution of ordinary shares, and additional information to support the presentation and classification requirements under the GAMA approach. Next, I'll briefly go through why and what we propose under each area of disclosures, and I'll leave time for the board to comment after each proposal.
And I'll complete the whole thing. Through the whole thing, given the time.
Okay. I'll go through all the disclosures and leave time for the board to comment at the end. Previously, we identified priority as a relevant feature of claims. However, this feature is not addressed through classification or presentation under GAMA, nor is it currently disclosed under IFRS. This makes it difficult to see the seniority of the entire financial instruments in financial statements. Accordingly, we propose that entities provide information on the priority of their financial instruments. This would be a new piece of disclosure covering both liabilities and equity. The objective is to help users assess how an entity's capital structure affects how various claim holders participate in the entity's prospects for future cash flows. The disclosure may take form of a capitalization table in which the entity lists its financial instruments in order of priority. Although disclosures about priority help users to assess the allocation of residual return amongst claims, they do not provide information on the potential dilution of ordinary shares. This issue is currently dealt with under IAS 33 earnings per share. However, users told us that they want information about any actual or potential increase in the number of ordinary shares, regardless of whether they are dilutive or anti-dilutive under IAS 33. Accordingly, we propose that entities provide information on dilutive instruments and outstanding ordinary shares. The objective is to help users assess the potential dilution of ordinary shares arising from financial instruments with share settlement options. To meet this objective, we think possible disclosures might include a complete list of all dilutive instruments and their related dilutive effects, and a reconciliation of the number of ordinary shares. We note that this would be an additional piece of disclosure. However, we think most of the relevant information is already required for people to calculate EPS under IAS 33. We also think the disclosure could be integrated with other IFRS standards such as IAS 1, therefore providing an opportunity to streamline some of the existing requirements. In addition, to support the attribution requirements for derivative claims under GAMA, we propose that entities provide information on a fair value measurement for derivative equity claims, especially reasons for the change in fair value. Such information is not currently required under existing IFRS and therefore would be a new piece of disclosure. We think requiring this information could raise the quality of equity disclosures to the same level as existing liability disclosures under IFRS 7 and help users assess the allocation of residual returns to derivative equity claims under GAMA. Does the board have any comments?
Martin. Yeah, I agree with the first two proposals, so about the priority of the claims. I would support that because that is really needed. Only one comment, what is then said, all the detailed disclosure about the groups of priorities with terms and conditions is too much. Because I think that maybe is a disclosure for single instruments you could do, but for a group, all this kind of detailed stuff, I think, I don't know how people should do that. And therefore, I think that is too much. Secondly, with information regarding the dilution, I also agree. But then thirdly, about what we have this of equity instruments, I have a question on paragraph 76. You say there should be a close reconciliation of the changes in fair value of these instruments, provide a description of the valuation techniques, provide sensitivity analysis. I ask me the question, why? Why do users need all this kind of information for this instrument?
do they do with it? It doesn't go into P&L, it doesn't affect anything. Why do they need sensitivity analysis, all this kind of information?
I think the for the sensitivity analysis, there are two types of reasons why users might that type of analysis. One is, you know, measurement uncertainty for, and we have similar types of disclosures under IFRS 13, for instance, for level 3 valuations. But the other reason is to understand the riskiness of a particular instrument. So for we're talking about derivatives that are classified, and this would only apply to derivatives that are classified as equity, and that would give them an idea of how sensitive those instruments are to changes in the fair value of changes in the value of the entity's own share price.
But again, for what reason?
So they can have
a kind of information, but why do investors need this kind of information? And you posit regarding 79, because you require all this information also for share-based payment stuff, that is not a reason. For me, that is not a reason.
Yeah.
You explain that okay, it's also required in IS2, and therefore we have to require it also here. I don't think so. That is a good reason to require this kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to answer it now, but think about
what
is really, what do investors do with this information? Maybe Steve can answer, I don't know. But I don't know, really. Steve.
Well, if you're the equity investor, you have a residual claim on the business. Other people have other types of claims. There's a certain amount of wealth in the business. You need to understand how that wealth is shared out amongst the claim holders. And you can only work out your interest in that company's wealth by understanding the interest of the other claim holders in that wealth. So I think information about claims is very important, not just for the shareholders at the end of the queue, but for everybody else as well, because they will have a slug of the income, the wealth, and they don't need to understand what is going to be siphoned off by somebody else before them, what's left to them, what they can take out of the business, and what then passes on to the next person.
And I understand that, but I don't understand why you need then a reconciliation of the values for this kind of equity claims, and why you need a description of the valuation techniques for this equity. Why you need sensitivity, and maybe I can understand that, but all this kind of detailed disclosure about how you come up with this kind of values, why do you need that? Is anybody doing their own calculation and then want to compare that with this calculation?
That's a wider question then about why do we need information about the techniques and assumptions we use in any calculation in financial reporting. So for fair value measurement for any other instrument, we have disclosures about the techniques and assumptions used. If we think that it's important there, and we think that the fair value information about other claims is important, why wouldn't we ask for the same disclosures in respect to those equity claims? You might argue that the IFRS 13 disclosures are excessive. That's something to look at, but that's a decision that we've made in respect of fair value measurement generally.
Gary.
I wanted to talk about other things, though. So this, the dilution, the priority table, the capitalization table, page 13, is it?
Mm-hmm.
What are these numbers? So are they fair values?
We have not specified. We didn't want to get into too much detail about whether fair values or carrying amount should be used. We just wanted to know whether information about the priority of the claims would be something that we would want to discuss in the discussion paper. If we think it's something that's potentially going to be useful, we could then talk about details about whether we use carrying values or fair values. Both are available for financial instruments, because both amortize, even if amortized cost is used in the financial statements, disclosure of fair value is required by IFRS 7, so we have the option there.
There's useful information in the ordering, although I would argue that it's not completely obvious what that order should be. So if I have a liability with a fixed charge on a specific asset, is that senior to another liability with a floating charge over many assets? And what about a charge over subsidiaries' assets versus a charge over... You can go on. So there's no obvious order to these things. And I think a description and information about the nature of the claims and the terms is actually more useful than the ordering in a table like this. But what I started to get very excited about when I saw this is I thought, well, finally we're going to have a fair value for the instruments for which we don't have a fair value at the moment. So yes, we have fair values for most of the liabilities at the top, but of course for finance leases we don't, which was an omission in our leasing standard. And we don't have fair values for things like the equity, for the derivatives classified as equity instruments. That's the big failing at the moment. So you have virtually no information about where you've got a carrying value, often very small, and big changes in fair value, and there's no transparency over the fair values of these things. So I started to get very excited when I thought this might be fair values, but sadly it doesn't seem to be.
And remember, Steve, for the equity instruments, we are going to be talking about attribution requirements for things that are senior to ordinary shareholders and or other claims other equity claims other than ordinary shares. And one of those possibilities is to fair value, and we are going to be thinking about updating carrying amounts, etc., which means that the information would potentially be there anyway. I guess the question here is whether, for instance, in the statement of financial position, on the face of it, it's typically presented in order of liquidity or current, non-current equity, whether a different ordered presentation summarized in terms of the order of priority would be useful information. There are questions, of course, about the details of how one might perform the ordering, and we'll need to as we develop the requirements, if this is potentially useful, we have to address those challenges. But the question is whether we think we want to start that discussion in as part of the discussion paper.
Can I comment on the second table? So page 20 and the dilution information. The problem with this is that it just gives one picture of dilution, which is the maximum number of shares. So we've got in here issuance of options, 1.5 million maximum additional potential ordinary shares. The problem is that if this is, let's say, an option that is out of the money, then you, under IAS 33, there'd be no dilution. So the equivalent figure would be zero. Now that's too small. This number of 1.5 million, I think, is too big. Now it has information in the sense, well, this is the additional share that could be issued, but it completely ignores the fact that if somebody exercises the option, they pay in a whole load of cash, and that increase in the cash balance could allow, for example, the company to go out in the market and buy back more shares than the 1.5 million, which is the sort of the theory under IAS 33. And what it doesn't take into account is the fair value of the option, which is the approach that I favoured in terms of earnings per share. So whilst this is sort of a welcome bit of additional information, I'm not sure that it's the best information in terms of the dilution.
We can, I guess, certainly challenge investors and users a bit more about why they've requested this. My understanding, and from the discussions that we've had with users and when they've asked for this, they've even asked for it when, for instance, there's potential shares issued at the money, so at fair value. And
But they're thinking of it for different reasons. So
yes, exactly.
There's the voting rights aspect, and then there's the value aspect.
That's right, but even when I pressed them on that, whether it was simply just for the voting rights and dilution of control, they said no, they want to know how the entity's been funded, how they've decided to increase their funding through share issuances versus other other sources of funding, whether all shareholders have shared in that the right to the additional shares, or whether it's a private placement matters to them, because that they get a smaller, their slice of the future pie gets smaller. So I think there's a few different reasons why they've requested this information. Part of it's to do with the limitations of IS 33, but I think there's some additional information that they're looking to get from this disclosure. We can certainly challenge them on that for additional details about how exactly they would use this information. But I think at this point we have received the request a number of times for this information, so we're just trying to be responsive to that.
Gary.
In relation, I support both tables 1 and 2. I think on table 1 on the cap table, my suggestion would be, if anything, we should probably keep this objectives based in terms of the outreach. Because as I look at a cap tables, at least since you referenced the SEC rules, they're actually defined what's in it. So you don't want to be too limiting by virtue of your point of reference. I would also say, if I look at a cap table, I don't think most pension corporate treasurers would think of pension plan deficit as part of their capitalization. So I think I would try to articulate this in terms, you could use something like this as an example in terms of what you're envisioning, but really got to articulate it in terms of objectives as opposed yes. to that. I think in general, at the parent company level, this is all relatively easy to do. It's when you've got interest in the subsidiary level. So here, non-controlling interest, so you have a minority interest in the subsidiary. In order to get that cash to the parent company, to satisfy the parent company, that several things have to happen. And one of which, you got to sell the subsidiary, you got to give them the money up, and so on and so on. You could, or just leave the subsidiary alone. I mean, so I think we should ask the question, when the capitalization is at a subsidiary level, it could be domestic, could be international, what challenges does that present in terms of structuring a cap table, ordering a cap table? And then I think we need to ask the question, or at least perhaps be cognizant, are we talking about the order of liquidation, we're talking an orderly wind-up or an involuntary bankruptcy? An orderly wind-up, presumably you'd follow the contractual terms in here. An involuntary bankruptcy, the bankruptcy laws come into play, and they perhaps might reorganize these things. And then even lastly, I think even within ordinary shareholders' equity, there's even tends to be subdivisions, restricted shares held by management directors who would generally be a lower priority than the average common shareholder who's just got it for investment purposes. So again, objectives, articulated mostly in terms of objectives, use this as a template for a visual, but.
Yes,
absolutely.
Philippe?
Yeah, quickly, I think Gary just made most of the points I wanted to make about the difficulty and the potentially misleading aspect of this table if we don't take care of the fact that it's most of the time much more complex than what it appears here, because some liabilities might be in subsidiaries, some others at parent company, etc. And the order of priority depends also on jurisdictions. You may have a country like the UK where the pension deficit has a higher seniority than maybe the finances, I don't know. So I think it would be difficult to be very prescriptive in the way to do it. It's more the idea of an objective. I think it would be even more useful if there was a prior column presented, so that there would be an understanding of how it relates to the financial position, and potentially to encourage some explanations about the variations, if not provided elsewhere, because most of the explanations will be provided by reconciliation tables, like finance leases. You can see how it has moved from X to Y, but some others are not presently provided. So maybe encourage explanations as to the big variations in this cap table.
Then the question raised by Steve about whether we use fair value or carrying value. I would prefer carrying value, and we also should be clearer in the DP for the following three reasons. Firstly, we should understand possible opposition of this proposal. or DP, because we recommend a lot of changes. And, you know, carry value versus fair value will give people totally different impression what we want. And secondly, use carry value has one of the advantage, that is the subtotals and the totals will be exactly the same as in the balance sheet. If we mixed with fair value and the book values or carry values, then the subtotals and the total will be something in between, looks like price change. And finally, you know, I don't think we will add fair value, which we're not required, either in a note or others. Therefore, all those fair value in a note, already there, don't worry, you know, they're somewhere in the financial statement or in the note. And so I don't think we lose anything. The fair value already there. So, but in short, I don't think, you know, it is such a, you know, good ideas to require fair value for this table. I don't think so.
Mary?
Kind of some general comments about, I think, how I suggest we look at this issue in the discussion paper. And it partly builds on Gary's point about to focus on objectives, maybe illustrating how one might think about satisfying the objectives, but not jumping right to the, we think we're going to eventually acquire X. The other thing I want to say is it's really good that the staff is bringing disclosures and a substantive consideration of disclosures into the DP stage, rather than saying we'll get to it once we set recognition and measurement requirements. It's really, really healthy to be thinking about this as a package. So credit to you for bringing something in which might seem like inconvenient right now, but I think it's good to be thinking about it. I'm inferring from some of the comments that the feedback we got was that people know and understand, for all its strengths and weaknesses, the EPS calculation. And you didn't hear, we've got to redo, rethink the EPS calculation to give a different diluted EPS. They're just rather pointing out that diluted EPS, the number itself, and the kind of sound bites that they get to support the calculation don't give them the kind of insights that they're looking for. So I take from that then that we can maybe be clearer about we're not rethinking EPS as part of this, as part of the answer to how do you provide additional information about dilution and priority. And maybe we should say that to just say what's in play, what's not in play. Then leads me to say, should we, as a first step, say, let's think about a requirement to publish the workings of EPS? Because right now we say you have to present EPS and you have to give certain sound bites about what the inputs were. But if we actually publish the workings, I think the feedback you had from investors was, with the information we get now, EPS doesn't answer these things. But if we're trying to think about building it up and isolating what's the additional information that's really necessary, if we said, let's start with saying, let's assume you publish EPS, what gaps then are still left? Because publishing EPS gives you some about the reconciliation from opening number of shares to closing number of shares. We know what transactions in the period and when they happened. Say, what additional pieces of information would be necessary to supplement it? Because I think the point about publishing the workings of EPS is that's something that everybody has to do now. They just don't have to include it in the financial statements now. So there's no additional work effort, or there should be no additional work effort to provide all that information, and it would help people understand that calculation more. And then I think we're talking about a much narrower range of additional things, rather than saying, well, you already need this for your EPS calculation, so with a little jigging around, you could present that number. I'm not sure it's the answer, but I think we should be exploring that in the DP, whether that's kind of a lower cost or streamlined approach to how much additional disclosure we layer on.
Dilution, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, because if you've got 30 or 40 dilutive instruments, your calculation is a binder. Especially if you're going average price or daily price or something, you know, for what's the weighted average of the period. So I think we got to be, sometimes you might need to be careful what you ask for. The question is, yeah, I agree, the EPS minimalist, you know, 100,000 net dividend options, you know, but you might have 10 million outstanding, some of the money, some out. So just be careful what we ask for. If the full thing could be massive, you get a complex company.
And it's not 100 pages that I'm thinking about.
No, I know you're not, but, you know, but.
And I mean, I'm familiar with, I don't know if it's still around, there used to be an SEC schedule requirement
12.
That says you have to present a schedule that basically is a summarized version of the working of EPS, and somehow they've.
Doesn't tell you a lot, but it's there.
So.
Just a couple of observations. I agree with the ideas you've gotten here and the types of tables that you're proposing, just a couple of specific thoughts. I also agree that I think setting an objective would help for the priority analysis, the cap table, to help people craft it the best way given the instruments they've got to deal with and their group structure. And I also think it would help us and people know whether to focus on carrying amounts fair values or amount claimed, because if you're looking at more of a, I don't know, a wind up type of focus, I guess the amount that's due might be even more relevant potentially than fair value or carrying amount. So it'll drive the focus. So I think thinking more about that would be good. Just another observation on the extra disclosures that Martin was talking about that are proposed for the fair values of the derivatives that have still got an equity label attached to them. As a general proposition, I agree with that's a good thing, but I think we need to be careful to make sure we can justify the amount of disclosure that we're asking for. And if you look at, so I don't know whether you've done it already, but I think looking at the disclosures we require about the methods, etc., where there's just a disclosure of fair values today as opposed to it being used in the statement of financial position would be a good anchor. And just looking quickly at that, I'm not sure we require sensitivities there.
Okay.
We do require the assumptions, etc., but not the sensitivities. And I think we might have a bit of a hard sell job for why we need all of that extra stuff for your own share derivatives if you don't for big other derivative positions.
Thank you.
Okay.
We don't need to vote, I believe.
So, based on that, if we have a discussion along these lines, taking into account your suggestions, you'd be happy for us to include that discussion in that discussion paper.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Hi, thank you very much.
Thank you.